Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, this is not the quickest cooking method. So this is more of a, you know, day around the fireplace that you're, you know, cracking walnuts and chatting and eating cheeses.
That sounds like an awesome way to start the holiday. Chef Daniel Orr throws a couple ducks over the fire to continue the prep for our holiday feast today. Harvest Public Media reports on how local food feeds the world. After that, Brad Dunn is back to talk about scotch and bourbon and giving the gift of booze this holiday. Then I speak with area craft distiller Matt Colglazier. His new spirit uses an old-fashioned local sugar source, sorghum. The guys at the rail then mix together a couple cocktails using that spirit. Lots of good stuff ahead today on Earth Eats. Welcome to Mia Partlow. She's got the food news headlines. What's happening in the world of food?
News this week centered around childhood obesity rates in the U.S. For the first time in 30 years, rates are on the decline. That's according to a report from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Mississippi, which had the highest rate of childhood obesity in the country in 2010, has recorded a statewide reduction of 13.3%. Unfortunately, the improvement is not distributed evenly across all segments of the population. In Mississippi, for example, obesity dropped only among white students. Even in places like New York City, where declines were reported across all demographics, declines were smallest among African American, Hispanic, and low-income children. Experts stress that their descriptive studies make no claims as to why youth obesity rates are declining in these places. The controversial new school lunch standards that went into effect this fall are now being lessened. In a letter to Congress, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the USDA will do away with daily and weekly limits of meats and grains. Restrictions on calories and salt in the meals are still in effect. The new guidelines had received praise from some parents and nutritionists, but others said the healthy meals were leaving kids hungry at school. The rules were intended to address childhood obesity levels. And milk sales in the United States peaked in the 1930s and have declined steadily ever since. According to the USDA, per capita milk consumption has fallen 30% since 1975. The past year alone has seen a 3.3% drop in milk sales, the biggest single-year drop since 1975. The biggest problem for dairy farmers, financially speaking, is that milk is cheaper than cattle feed. The federal government sets a minimum price for milk, but it hasn't been adjusted to accommodate increased feed and fuel prices, nor to account for decreased output caused by the 2012 drought. The issue is complicated by Congress's ongoing inability to pass a farm bill. If legislators fail to pass a new bill or an extension of the old one, policies would revert to a 1949 law. Among other impacts, this law would double the price of milk. Read these news stories on our website, eartheats.org.
And keep up with the latest food news headlines by following us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow reads our food news every week. Thanks.
See you soon.
The United States is the world's leading corn producer and exporter, supporting the increasing demand for meat in China, India, and other countries with growing middle classes. Those countries import livestock feed made from Midwestern grain. But as Amy Mayer reports for Harvest Public Media, feeding the world will take more than shipping protein overseas.
It's the holiday season, so you'll probably soon be hearing this 1980s pop song, which accompanied hunger relief efforts. The United States has a history of food aid, and Midwest grain certainly has its role. But sending corn, soybeans, and other food abroad is just part of the equation when it comes to figuring out how we'll feed the 9 billion people projected to be on the Earth in 2050. World Food Prize laureate and former international aid worker Catherine Bertini applauds bipartisan efforts that have refocused American food policy on farming. She spoke recently at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
The administration now, for the first time in a long time, decided, yes, it's a good idea to put more effort into agriculture development.
That means helping all farmers succeed, not just distributing food to the hungry. Governments, nonprofits, and private businesses all have a place in the effort. Seed companies, for example, are developing technologies specific to regions all over the globe. Mike Vandelaar, the chief operating officer of Winfield, a Land O'Lakes subsidiary, says advances in seed technology can have global impact, and the biggest players know to innovate locally, wherever that is.
Generally, the most productive genetics are the ones that are developed within the area where the plant breeding has been done.
If your target market is China, he says, set up a lab there. And eventually, the technology will help Chinese farmers increase yield. Bertini says the U.S. government's Feed the Future program, a commitment to help ensure the world has enough to eat, emphasizes local food production. In places where people are hungry, the program supports small farming efforts because those have a ripple effect.
The World Bank says that agricultural productivity is 2 to 4 times as effective as any other productivity in alleviating poverty.
Today, the world's growing population relies on a combination of international trade, food aid from the rich countries to the poor as needed, and increased local production.
I have two high tunnels, and we use one of them for tomatoes and then the other one for
cucumbers. We need to produce as much to feed the world as we can, but also people like to eat local, locally grown foods too. So there's a case for both sides of agriculture.
That's Boone County, Iowa farmer Greg Reinhart. This greenhouse-like high tunnel extends the growing season for some of the vegetables and fruit his family grows on 100 acres and sells at farmers markets. But on 700 acres, they grow traditional row crops.
Once we sell it, though, we don't actually know exactly where it's going, but we know it's not being wasted. It's being used somewhere in the food chain, whether in the United States or it's being exported to many countries in the world.
Given the rich soil and well-developed infrastructure here, Midwestern farmers are likely to continue playing an important role on the world food scene. But Iowa State University economist Bruce Babcock says the goal of domestic production around the world isn't as far off as many people seem to think.
The overwhelming supply of calories and food that is consumed in most countries comes from the country that is the consuming country.
So the persistent challenge is distribution. And even rich countries haven't figured out how to get food to everyone who needs it. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Last week, we had Brad Dunn in the studio to talk about wine for the holidays. Today, it's booze, bourbon, whiskey, and his favorite, scotch. He encourages you to step out of your alcoholic comfort zone, so to speak, and try a bottle of something different this holiday season. These days, there are so many more options beside the big labels.
Craft distilling is really coming up behind this wave of craft brewing.
Dunn is the sommelier and beverage director at the Uptown Cafe.
It's a little more difficult to open up, you know, a craft distillery, the laws, first of all, and obviously it's legal to brew beer at home, whereas I'm sure you may or may not know, it's not legal to distill. Hence the caricature of moonshining.
In this part of the country, we might then think about bourbon. Bourbon is a type of whiskey, so is scotch. Here's the rule, something I can never remember. All bourbon is whiskey, not all whiskey is bourbon.
Whiskey is just a generic term. You know, it's like saying car. I think the most important thing to understand about bourbon is that it's based on an age-old recipe, and it has to do with the percentage of corn. So bourbon is made from a mash bill, which is essentially the recipe, essentially, that is 51% or more corn. Another huge misconception about bourbon, that bourbon is from Kentucky, with good reason, because Kentucky is sort of the one of the most associated. It's like the Napa Valley of bourbon, you could say. But bourbon can be from anywhere within the United States.
Similarly, scotch is produced in Scotland. There are all these rules that dictate what makes scotch scotch. It's outlined in the Scotch Whiskey Regulations of 2009. It must be distilled in Scotland and matured in oak casks in Scotland for at least 3 years. They are not messing around. The big names include Chivas and Johnny Walker Black Label, which is a blend of 40 whiskeys, each aged for at least 12 years.
Most scotch that we buy is at these big houses like Black Label and Chivas and all that are blends. They're blends of maybe 20 up to maybe 50 different scotches, which are great. Blends are great. But if you want to just put 2 minutes of thought into it, try and find a single malt.
That means the scotch has been distilled with malted barley and only barley. The grain is soaked in water for 2 to 3 days, allowing it to germinate and produce the enzymes needed to process starch into fermentable sugars. And then single means that the malt comes from only one distillery, unlike blended scotches. Single malts give the scotch lover more to latch onto in terms of depth and variety of flavor.
So if you get a scotch that's, you know, light and maybe citrusy, you know, it's a more delicate scotch. It's really nice on the rocks with a twist. And you go all, you can run all the way through to ones that are, have more brown sugar, that are almost more bourbon-like. And then you go over, you know, a little bit west into the Islay scotches and some, you know, some of them, you know, it's like drinking a campfire. If you, you know, any of my buddies that are out there, if you can't think of what to get me, scotch.
Here's Brad Dunn's holiday gift request. He'll be back in a couple weeks to talk about champagne for New Year's. He was talking about the burgeoning craft distilling movement. In the second half of the show, we'll talk with a local spirit maker who has crafted a drink that is 100% Hoosier. Get tips for enjoying a tasty yet responsible holiday season at eartheats.org.
Well, it's wine, oh wine, oh wine. Oh, wine, oh wine, oh wine. Yeah, oh wine, oh wine, oh wine.
All right, so let's get these ducks going.
Last week, Chef Daniel Orr baked some brie over an open fire so good. This week, he's making the main dish for our holiday feast.
You can, if you want to, you can cook duck so it's kind of medium rare and pink inside, but we're going to do more of a traditional roast duck where we're going to let it get really nice and crispy and crunchy and have that great crisp skin.
That's the best part.
Yeah. But first what we want to do is season our ducks, and I've got two small ducks from Maple Leaf Farm right here in Indiana, and I'm going to season them with some salt and pepper. Always using fresh ground pepper, so it has all those nice essential oils in it.
So you're flipping them now, so you're going to do salt and pepper on both sides.
Season both sides. And we're going to cut up a little bit of citrus to stick inside. And what that does is kind of helps cut the greasiness a little bit and gives you that nice perfume. The juice is, you know, acid, and then the zest has this wonderful fragrance of citrus that will just really perfume the ducks. So I'll put about a half a lemon in each one. And then we're going to add, of course, garlic, which is one of our favorite flavors. Okay, so we're just going to cut this garlic clove kind of east to west, so you really expose all of the openings of the garlic. And then we're going to put some rosemary and thyme inside.
Is this a case where you could season it however you like, or are these
spices and these flavors especially great for duck?
Well, these do go really nice with duck. I mean, the rosemary has that kind of oily, piney aroma to it, which is really nice with the duck. And the richness and the fattiness of the duck will really pick up these flavors of citrus and the pininess of the rosemary. Thyme's another good one. And these herbs are also herbs that kind of last later into the fall and early winter outside. If you cover them up with some leaves from the garden, you can kind of keep them going almost through the new year.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we've got this beautiful fire. How long has this been going, Gretchen?
I lit it about 7 o'clock.
This morning?
Yes.
You don't want a whole lot of flame. You don't want to cook over a high flame. And as you can see here, I've got this little pan that we're going to catch the drippings on. And I'm going to put the ducks towards the back because I don't want them just to drip on the fire and have a lot of flare up. So we're just going to start these guys. We'll start them on the breast side down.
So you're putting breast side down to get it nice and crispy. How long is it going to sit there?
Well, these can take, you know, this is not the quickest cooking method. So this is more of a, you know, day around the fireplace that you're, you know, cracking walnuts and chatting and eating cheeses, and the ducks slowly cook on the over the fire
and drinking wine
and eggnog. So it's not something that you're going to rush. I would say probably about an hour and a half to 2 hours on the grill.
Well, we are starting at about 10 in the morning. So when would we eat?
That'd be probably mid afternoon.
That's perfect, right? Because yeah. You can still watch a football game.
Right.
True. Liver's going there. This we're going to let go a little bit quicker. I'm going to move these ducks just back a little bit.
Just over here, we have the organ meats from the duck cooking up in a pan.
Yeah, kind of spitting out at us. I'm going to throw a little bit of my sweet seasoned spice blend. It has some of those kind of Christmassy aromas to it. And these will be great in stuffing, or we can mix them in with a little bit of wild rice, which would be really tasty. You can use the necks for stock, but there's still actually a good amount of meat, and my mother loves to chew on these necks, so we'll probably just throw them right on the grill with the ducks.
Coming up, a local craft distiller goes back in time.
I mean, really, nothing more than a simple machine ever touches any of this from the time it's a seed to the time it's actually in the bottle.
Matt Colglazier sources the sorghum he uses in his new spirit from a southern Indiana Amish farmer. While this makes the spirit especially Hoosier, it presents plenty of challenges as well. Come back for that.
In Arkansas, they serve you coleslaw. That's good strategy without a flaw. It's a cinch to draw a plate of coleslaw. It ain't nothing but some cabbage raw. No bread, no meat, no potatoes, and nothing as sweet. All I want.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. There's a new craft spirit on the market that can claim 100% homegrown Indiana status. Sorghum, America's first sweet sorghum spirit.
Creator Matt Kohlglaser is a spirits enthusiast who decided to take his hobby to the next level.
Hi, Annie.
Hi.
Through his American Craft Spirits website, he's tasted spirits from all over the country, none of which were using sorghum.
And at that point, that's where my idea kind of came in and was like, well, this is a homegrown sugar source. Why is nobody making this into booze?
Kohlglaser speculates that potential distillers may have been deterred by how labor-intensive it is to prep sorghum. It looks like corn, but is taller and has no ears. Sorghum grows like sugarcane, so the juice is in the stalk. The stalks are dried out and then pressed in a mill. Then the sugar is boiled, similarly to how maple syrup is prepared.
The only people who did it were, like, farmers who were probably not drinkers and Amish people who are definitely not drinkers. So you had a product that's, like, the only people who want to make this are people who have, like, an incredible work ethic and no time for leisure and go to bed at 6 o'clock. So, no, you know, none of those people were like, hey, let's turn this into booze. So that was my job.
When he first started forming the idea 2 years ago, he wanted to plant his own sorghum. But he scratched that and eventually got in touch with an Amish farmer who lives near Bromer, Indiana.
You know, when I first approached him about it, I said, well, where do you get seeds for something like this? And he goes, oh, those seeds? Those have been in my family for 48 years. So that's like some of these mills that have been reclaimed are like 110 years old. I mean, they don't make new sorghum mills because it's a very old-timey thing. And in case of the Amish, that's even more unmechanized because, I mean, really nothing more than a simple machine ever touches any of this from the time it's a seed to the time it's actually in the bottle. So that's like to give you a perspective on what I'm trying to do and then the people that I'm trying to work with. It's a very weird and interesting thing.
The next step required collaboration as well, because unlike beer and wine, you can't produce spirits for beverage purposes out of your own home. So we joined forces with Stuart Hobson, the owner of Heartland Distilling in Indianapolis.
I had to partner up with Stuart because he had the equipment, he had the still. You know, when he tasted that first batch and we were just thrilled and excited about how interesting it tasted, you know, we were both sold. It's like tequila, but it's not. It's like white rum, but it's not. It's really its own flavor profile. It's sweet, it's earthy.
One of the few places you can order a drink made with sorghum is The Rail in Bloomington.
My name is Benjamin Zemel, or Ben, you can call me Ben, and my title here is bartender.
Ben is going to be mixing a couple cocktails for us, which incorporates sorghum. He says it works best in a sour, which is 2 ounces of liquor to a half ounce of sweetener and 3/4 of an ounce of acid. From that basic formula, you can then get creative however you like.
It always makes things interesting when we can work off of a new product. You know, something that's not, you know, the same thing done over and over and over again, but something that's really original. Okay, so we're going to start with something that people can actually make at home on their own, and this is going to be a sorghum sour. So we start off with 2 ounces of sorghum. Both of these cocktails will be using the white sorghum. Then we're going to use simple syrup, which is a 2-to-1 mixture of water to sugar. So what we're going to do is use a 1/2 ounce of this, and we're going to use some fresh squeezed lemon juice, and you're going to want to use 3/4 of an ounce. And then finally, we're going to put 1 white of an egg. It'll give the drink a little bit of personality, make it light and fluffy, and have a great texture. Cool. So then we serve these in a coupe and a sidecar glass. And what you're going to want to do is, all this is done in your shaker, your 16-ounce shaker. You're going to fill that up with ice. Fill it to the very, very top. We're going to put that in our 23-ounce shaker and just shake it like crazy. And then we're going to double strain this into the glass. Typically when you're shaking a drink, little pieces of ice break up into that. When you double strain, what you do is you minimize the amount of ice that's going to be in that drink. So you have less water and more, you know, spirit and acid and sweet and all that good stuff. And as you can see, this is a very fluffy drink.
You had this drink?
I have, yeah. I think the basic sour is the best. It's one of the best things for it. Again, like a simple margarita works really well with it. Anything lemon, anything lime, perfect.
For a garnish, what we can use is a little bit of Angostura bitters and just drop it around the drink, and then with a little bar straw, you can make a pretty little design. And our cocktail is finished. Okay, so the next drink that we're going to do is called the Hellfire Sorghum Sour. And the reason that it's called the Hellfire Sorghum Sour is because we use this Bitterman's Hellfire Habanero Shrub in it, which is quite spicy.
And this is not going to be an ingredient that people have in their homes.
Generally,
probably.
No. You're not going to find most people with the Hellfire Shrub at their house, as well as Orgeat Syrup, which is an almond sweetener. Orgeat. So just like the other cocktail, we're going to start with 2 ounces of the sorghum, the light sorghum. And instead of simple syrup this time, we're going to use 1/2 ounce of the Orgeat syrup. In this sour, we're gonna use both lemon and lime juice. So you're going to want to do 1/3 ounce of each one. So this is where the Hellfire comes in. So we're going to put 1/3 eyedropper of this Hellfire shrub into the Hellfire sorghum sour. And then again, we're going to do the white of 1 egg. Just like the other one, we're going to fill up our 16-ounce shaker with ice, and we are going to shake it.
I should have been timing you. Do you just do this, like, as long as you feel like it?
Well, you can actually kind of tell how well it's being shaken by how cold the shaker gets, so you can kind of feel it as you go.
Again with the double straining.
Exactly. We're going to double strain this again so we don't get little chips of ice in our cocktail.
So now this one's going to be spicy.
This one's going to have some heat to it, yes. But you'll still be able to taste the integrity of the sorghum in there. Well, we've got quite a bit here. And just like the other, we're going to do another garnish. This time we're going to use Hellfire Habanero Shrub. Just going to drop that around the cocktail a few different places. And we're also going to use some Angostura bitters, mainly for color. Take another little bar straw, and we have our finished cocktail.
And actually, I've not tried this drink, so I'm kind of curious to... Ooh. Yeah, I like it. You know, it's really interesting how dry that tastes on the end, on the finish. So it's a different, you know, antidote to like a lot of the sweeter cocktails that are out there. You know, you're not just drinking... You don't feel like you're just drinking sugar and booze.
Thanks to Ben Zemel and Matt Kohlglaser. See recipes for both of these cocktails and check out the photos from our afternoon at the Rail. Our website is eartheats.org. And if you're intrigued by sorghum, check out their website at sorghum.com. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Matt Kohlglaser, Brad Dunn, Sarah Gordon, Liz Leslie, Mia Partlow, Chef Daniel Orr, Ben Zemel, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh local organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, Massage and Yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Hope to see you again next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.